You're listening to ANCSA at 50. The journey continues. I'm Rhonda McBride. Thank you for joining us. This show is designed as a companion series to run in tandem with KTOO's 360 TV's Thursday night series on the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. Seven programs that lead up to the 50th anniversary of the signing of ANCSA on December 18th. This is the second in the series, which features a memorable conversation that Nellie Moore recorded 10 years ago for the occasion of the 40th anniversary of ANCSA called Women Behind the Act.
Hello, I'm Nellie Moore. Welcome to ANCSA 40, commemorating the 40th anniversary of the passage of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. Much has been written about the politics and men of ANCSA, but little mention has ever been made of the women behind the act, powerful women who ran their households and raised their families while they led multi-million dollar organizations. I was fortunate to speak with three of them during events marking the 40th year of ANCSA. They're women who played an active role in negotiating different aspects of the Land Claims Act.
Nellie Moore spoke with three remarkable women who fought for the Land Claims Act: Marlene Johnson from Southeast Alaska, Brenda Italy from Utqiagvik, known then as Barrow, and Frances Degnan from Unalakleet.
We had no funds whatsoever, and so we were all so impassioned about uplifting, bringing everybody forward together.
These women talked about things that aren't widely known about the fight for land claims. Nellie Moore, who was originally from Kotzebue, is here to provide us with some context, as well as Jacqueline Estes, a Thlinkit and a national correspondent for Indian Country Today. Both have covered the Alaska Federation of Natives Convention extensively. Paul Ontaguk is an Inupiat who taught Alaska Native Studies at the University of Alaska Anchorage. He joins us. And lucky for us, ANCSA history is one of his specialties. So, Nellie, I'm going to start with you because you were the one who did this interview. But I have to ask, how many interviews do you think that you've done about the Claims Act over the years? And, you know, just take a guess for us.
1,000?
And you're not kidding either, are you?
No.
Every AFN, you know, it's a topic of interest because you have young people coming up and some who are dissatisfied and become outspoken at the AFN convention or whatever. But there's always something going on, background, foreground, middle ground, down in the art store. But yeah, it's a hot topic no matter where you are.
Well, some things never change, do they? But I am curious, why were these particular women chosen for this interview?
Well, they were from different parts of Alaska. After the passage of ANCSA, they also came forward as leaders of their own corporations or their own groups of people. Very strong leaders.
That was a special conversation, though. I mean, it felt like you were sitting down at a kitchen table with those three women.
We had so much fun. We laughed so much.
So, Paul, you're familiar with Brenda Italy. Can you tell us a little bit about her?
A force to be reckoned with. She is a presence when she comes into a room. You just notice her. She's sharp. She's always very, very careful with her words. She's got a very dry sense of humor. If you're on the receiving end of it, it's always just spot on and funny at the same time. We did a number of workshops for new employees, particularly managers for Arctic Slope Regional Corporation. And in those meetings, she would share her perspectives about how Arctic Slope Regional Corporation came about. She also was a key person in helping to form Illisavik College, which is why I was in Barrow at the time as a professor for Illisavik College. And she worked with enormous energy to try to keep that organization focused and to try to keep it from being swallowed by all of these competing perspectives on what the college should do and could do. It was remarkable to have been a part of it. Sort of the mouse in the room at both levels. It's a treat to watch people very calmly sort their way through storms that happen at that level, at the level that they're operating on.
So Jocelyn, you're familiar with Marlene Johnson. Tell us a little bit about her background.
Well, Marlene Johnson grew up in Hoonah, which is a fishing village west, a little southwest, I think, of Juneau. And she was a child in the 1940s and 50s when racism was absolutely right in your face, with segregated movie theaters, signs that said no natives or dogs allowed. She told the story one time of being in school and being told to write on the chalkboard 100 times, "I will not talk Indian," being punished for having spoken Tlingit at school. And she said that it was very humiliating. But in the 60s, she was elected to the executive committee of the Tlingit and Haida Central Council. And she started going back to Washington, D.C. with John Borbridge in those early days of lobbying for the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. And she found her voice. I mean, Marlene Johnson has been active ever since. And after ANCSA was adopted, there were people who were bitterly, bitterly disappointed. We thought we were going to get a per capita distribution, that we would be getting checks, or that we would be getting land individually, that land would come to us on a per capita basis. And what happened instead is the land and money went to a for-profit corporation, which issues dividends. The dividends are not life-changing, even the good ones. If you're getting a dividend check from Sea Alaska, you're not independently wealthy by a long shot. And Marlene Johnson was one of the incorporators of Sea Alaska, and then she was on the board of directors. And I saw her just go through fire. The people who were shareholders at the annual meetings, they just ripped into the board of directors, and the attacks were sometimes personal. Everybody who was in those positions was trying so hard to do the right thing, and they were getting very little appreciation for it.
Well, in Nellie's interview with Marlene Johnson, she talks a little bit about after ANCSA, when she was running for chairman of the board. So let's listen to this clip a little bit to hear what Marlene Johnson says it was like to be a woman during that time period.
We had one of our board members who was an elder that talked to the board and said, "We cannot. Sea Alaska is just too important to our community, our shareholders, to have a woman be the chairman." And that really was kind of the feeling at that time.
From what she experienced, you do get a sense of just how tough women had to be. So Nellie, the third woman in your interview is also an amazing woman, Frances Degnan. And you know, by the time I met her, she was famous for her knitting. And I had no idea she was one of the early fighters for land claims. And really all I knew is that she used yarn from muskox.
Actually, one time when we had a meeting at Native Student Services, maybe, she gave us all smoke rings that she had knitted from patterns from Unalakleet, and I was really impressed. I was blown away. Anyway, she has a very interesting background. She's been active at the regional level, and the family has been very politically active. Frances Degnan's father was Frank Degnan, and he was a very well-known leader. He was in the first territorial legislature, and he later helped form AFN. So that probably led to some of her leadership initiatives that she grew into.
So I'm going to play a cut right now that we have from your interview with Frances, talking about sort of where people were at the time that the land claims fight began. And these were pretty amazing beginnings. So let's listen.
We lived underground. Those were underground subterranean homes during the winter. And then we came up out of the ground in the summertime. And that was the time of my grandmother. And she said that the animals would come in, and we lived in harmony with the earth and with the people. And anyone passing through, no matter which direction they're coming from, that you welcomed them in, you took care of them, because that was a charge from the Creator. We didn't have high schools, so we just went as far as the eighth grade. And my parents and their colleagues went as far as the third grade. It just depended on how they were needed at home to bring in the subsistence food, because that's the only operating economy we had.
When you think of the journey that leaders like Francis Degnan had, going from underground homes to having the sophistication it took to fight for land claims, Paul, does this give you an appreciation for just what an amazing story this is?
The generation that organized around the issue of land claims in the 1960s were inheriting a legacy of trying to achieve a land claim settlement from earlier generations. Those had been going on since non-natives had arrived as sort of pioneer settling cultures. There had been resistance and negotiations trying to gain acknowledgement of the different cultural groups' rights to lands and waters. The group that organized in the 1960s were facing the tsunami of this confluence of billions and billions of dollars worth of oil that were now going to come onto market. And it was an international event as well. We have to understand, in 1967, the real kickoff was the Arab-Israeli War of 67, where OPEC, controlled largely by the Arabic nations, actually used oil as a weapon against other nations by declaring an oil embargo for anyone who supported Israel. And that sent a shockwave through the system of industries and nations completely dependent on oil. So it wasn't as though people weren't aware that oil was in Alaska. It was suddenly vital for the United States to develop a new counterweight to the power of OPEC in controlling the independence of the United States, because we were just tied to Mideast oil in a way that was virtually a stranglehold. It becomes more important to discover oil in Alaska and large quantities of it. And so that's a part of this international context, that this group of Alaska Native peoples you're just coming into this, and the world suddenly is dropping on Alaska for a variety of reasons. And the question is, how do we respond? Can we respond? Can we work together? Can we overcome our recent history of not only trade, but conflict? So they're facing these enormous odds and certainly not being prepared to handle this. We were educated as Alaska Natives to be primarily laborers for other people. We weren't being educated to determine our own future. It was quite the opposite. The idea was that we were going to disappear as cultural groups and as tribes. This was an explicit goal of the United States government, and it was also the perspective that pioneer Alaskans who controlled the state had about Native peoples, was that we were supposed to give up being Native as a bargain of American citizenship and participation. So they're facing not only the politics of it, they're facing this cultural conflict as well. It's amazing to me that we're able to see a generation like that rise to the occasion as well as they did and face so many of these enormous conflicts and manage them not perfectly. No group does that I'm aware of, and not without flaws. Everyone can see the shortcomings after the fact, right? A few people saw it coming. They anticipated some of the flaws that were being baked into ANCSA. But still in all, you look at it and you just have to go back to what if they had just set it out? What if Brenda Itali and Francis Dignan and all of these people, if they had just said, this is a lot of work, the prospects of success are small, and the threats of participating are huge and multifaceted. So what if they had just looked at it and said, no, we're not going to do it. And instead, they jumped in and they participated. They all contributed, not at the same time, not in the same ways, but they contributed to a future where we can argue about, well, couldn't they have been more successful? And what are the things that they left out? You know, I like to say is, well, they left some work for the next generation to pull off and to correct. So there's that.
But why is it that we hear so little about the role that women played?
The communications were very limited. Really, we were using crank phones. Most towns, Kotzebue being a rather large one, only had 3 long distance lines out going. The coverage was slow coming. We had no television. When we did get television, it was on tapes and it was tape delayed. So we saw sometimes it was a week late. So how could women's issues be well known when they were so in the background? Not to mention the fact that it was more like, we just need them to stay home and watch the kids, keep the household going. Somebody had to be there. It was usually the women. And so they had to work really hard to raise money for their tickets and find somebody to take care of their kids while they were gone. So it was not a cheap thing for them.
I think Marlene Johnson went on to say in your interview that she relied on elders to help her out, that they would watch her children for her. And she said it was a lucky thing because her youngest daughter learned Tlingit from being around elders so much.
You know, that's a great example. I wish I had more of that opportunity because neither one of my grandparents spoke English.
So Jacqueline, there is such an underappreciation of the role of women. I'm sure that you've heard a lot growing up from your own family about the things that women did to help in the land claims fight that basically are unknown.
Yeah, the biggest example of that, I would say, is the role of Tilly Paul Tamry, who's my great-grandmother. So Chief Shakes, my great-grandfather, also known as Charlie Jones, went to vote. And when he got to the polling place, the officials told him, no, you can't vote because you're an Indian. So he left and he was talking with Tilly Paul Tamry about it. She was an elder in the Presbyterian Church. And they were both people in prominent positions in the community. She came back to the polling place with him and insisted that he be allowed to vote. And they were both later arrested, him for voting illegally and she for aiding and abetting him to vote. And her son, William Paul Sr., took the case to court and won Alaska Natives the right to vote. This was in 1920 and 21. How many of you guys have heard of her before, Paul and Nellie and Rhonda?
No. I've never heard of her.
Right. So there are unsung heroes.
Nellie, I think that's why those interviews that you did 10 years ago are so important, because we wouldn't know otherwise exactly how these women got involved. So Nellie, I think this would be a good time to play part of your interview with Brenda Itta, because she talks about how the women were very worried about what was going to happen.
I often overheard some of my aunts and women talk about concerns about the land, and we used furs from caribou, caribou fawn, seals for our clothing and as well as our food. So the women were, I believe, just as concerned, especially as mothers, you know, how do we feed our children? With Puddle Bay discovered, how are we going to still catch our caribou? What about our polar bears? What about our anaklik, our nelik, our ducks and our geese? So the women were very much involved in our meetings.
So I want to follow with another cut from Nellie's interview. This one is from Fran Degnan, who talks about all the sacrifices that had to be made by both men and women alike.
We did this all on our own pocket.
How could you manage that? I mean, talked about being young parents, young women.
I would save my money, and then I paid for my father's and my travel when AFN couldn't do it. So, and then we live a subsistence way of life, so our food was there, and we could catch it year-round. Mm-hmm. So the cash went strictly for our travel, cab fare, hotels. And I always made sure that I had a budget, and things didn't cost as much then as they did today. My father always said this: we were rich, but we were just cash poor. So the thing is, your mission was to keep the land secure that the Creator gave you, and our goal is to get to God. So, big charge.
You know, when you hear about these types of sacrifices, it really gives you a whole different sense of angst and what families had to go through.
I would say so. I mean, that was a huge part of their responsibility, was providing that babysitter with enough money to feed the kids while they were gone, somehow come up with a household budget where the money their husbands might have made and the money they put in would make their payments. At one point, they were saying that a lot of the men who were involved in the ANCSA negotiations were behind on their mortgages and their car payments. Back then, it wasn't as easy to say, oh, sorry, I'll make it up.
All right, this seems like we're in a good place to take a break. We have been talking with two longtime Alaska Native journalists, Nellie Moore and Jocelyn Estes, along with Paul Ungtaguk, who taught Native Studies at the University of Alaska, and one of his specialties is ANCSA history. When we come back, we'll hear some more of their stories about the women behind the act, and I bet there are some that you have probably never heard or imagined. And we're going to save the best one for last, how three women were offered up as collateral for a loan from the Yakima Indian tribe to fund the land claims fight. A true but strange story. So stay with us. Are listening to ANCSA at 50, The Journey Continues, the radio companion program to a series that airs every Thursday night on KTOO's 360 TV, leading up to December 18th, the 50th anniversary of the signing of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. This series, which features films and documentaries from over the years, is maybe a chance to do a little armchair time traveling. And here to help me with that, Nellie Moore, who hosted the program that we are airing this Thursday night at 8 on KTOO's 360 TV, the second in the series. It is an intimate conversation with three women who were early leaders in the fight for land claims: Marlene Johnson from Southeast Alaska, Brenda Italee from the Arctic Slope, and Frances Degnan from the Bering Straits region. So, Paul, I want to pick up where we left off, because we were talking about the many sacrifices that families had to make. And that, in many ways, is an untold story.
I do know that for Alaska Natives involved in land claims, it was done during an era in which J. Edgar Hoover's FBI So most of them got their very own little investigative file for each of them. And if they were too prominent or seen as too successful in negotiating on behalf of Alaska Natives, it was a remarkable coincidence that they would all get their own IRS audit of their taxes for the prior years. And those were just some of the factors that were going on. It could affect your jobs, stability. If you were renting a home, it was a risky thing to be a part of the whole land claim struggle, and there were consequences for that. It was all three of the major newspapers in Alaska, the Juneau Empire, the Fairbanks News Miner, and the Anchorage Times. They weren't above naming names as to who was involved in Alaska Native politics and drawing a personal attention on who they were and what role they were playing. And the general tenor was that anybody who was arguing on behalf of Alaska Native peoples was anti-white, anti-Alaskan, against the development of the state, holding back the progress of the future. And they were just being vilified, which is a part of the reason for the necessity to create the Tundra Times as an Alaska Native statewide newspaper, because otherwise we just wouldn't have a newspaper that was reflecting our interests and concerns. Behind all of this and surrounding this are the active role of Alaska Native women in making so much of this happen. Sometimes in ways that were narrowed and framed by the politics and the culture of the majority at the time. One of the things that people, I think, may not be aware of is that we have to understand that at a crucial juncture, getting the White House and getting to Richard Nixon, who actually is one of the great supporters of Native Americans in modern American history. I know he's got a terrible legacy in some aspects, but he was one of the very best partners and supporters of Native American rights of any president in the modern era. Well, how do you get his attention when things are going the way they are? Well, it turned out that Spiro Agnew, who was a vice president, was somebody who had a crush on Laura Burt when they were in college. She apparently did not pay that much attention to him, but he knew her definitely and remembered her quite clearly. And so
Paul, can you tell us a little bit about who Laura Burke was? Because I know she was quite beautiful, but apparently she was very important. And all of the women that Nellie interviewed said that she was a key player in this.
Absolutely. Well, one of the things you have to understand about Laura Burke was that when the Alaska Territorial Guard was organized in the 1940s during World War II, one of the qualifiers being a member was that you had to shoot a qualifier with a rifle. And she shot first place in her village. She outshot everybody, not the women. She outshot everybody.
Okay, now wait a minute. She's from Kotzebue.
Yeah, but when she was qualifying, she was in Buckland at the time. That's where they right. were recruiting when she volunteered to show up. So it was, you know, it was kind of a stand up and take notice moment for people. And it's one of those things that there were women in the Alaska Territorial Guard. They did not make the official veterans list.
That's a great story. Out.
Yeah, but it was known. And it's something that Muktuk Marston put on record. So it's no longer secondhand story. It was something that he volunteered for history. And she was a stunning beauty by all counts. If you've seen any photos, she was, yes, all that, as well as being incredibly sharp. So it was her personal connection that got a meeting with Spiro Agnew initially by representatives of the Alaska Federation of Natives. And it was from that connection that you ended up with being able to get into the White House and start negotiating on that side. And once you got past the layer of administrators within the White House so that you had a direct connection with Nixon, that was always the frightening concern for his administration, because they understood that whenever it came to Native American politics, that Richard Nixon was more than willing to offend Western state governors, Republican or Democrat, in promoting their interests. And it was seen by his staff as politically expensive whenever Richard Nixon became aware of a Alaska Native or Native American issues. That connection in part comes from this personal connection of Laura Burt.
And there were a lot of national leaders that came to Anchorage and were given tours by, you know, Native leaders around the state going to this village or that village. But, you know, you could, one day you could see Scoop Jackson or someone from, you know, another member of Congress here in
Daniel Inouye.
Yeah. Hmm?
Daniel Inouye.
Yeah. And they were just walking around like the common man. And little did you know, they were paraded through one at a time. And I think that part was very effective also.
So I've got another comment I want to play. And this is Brenda Itto sort of talking about the passion that people felt for the land claims fight. And so here's you, Nellie, asking Brenda about what it was like to grow up in the middle of the land claims fight. Let's listen.
What a way to grow up, being involved in this tremendous piece of legislation from a very young age. Mm-hmm. I mean, most people are wondering, you know, where am I going to get my next Barbie?
So many of us throughout the state were raised the traditional way. And as Frances stated earlier, we were taught to live in harmony with the land, the ocean, the rivers. Wherever we lived in harmony with nature. And we were very dependent mm-hmm. on the creation to help us to survive. So it was very natural for us to speak up very easily, because to speak up for our rights. Mm-hmm. And in many instances, actually, it was our divine rights given to us by our Creator. It was divine.
Paul, you were talking earlier about the world descending on Alaska Natives and powerful forces like oil industries suddenly interrupting a way of life that was cherished for thousands of years.
The conflict is about lands and waters, and it's also about perspectives of the role of people in the world. And the traditional beliefs have this common theme that we as humans are not the center of the planet. We're not the center of the world. We're not the ones who are above it all, sort of organizing it. Instead, we're just a part of this very rich and dynamic community that actually has to give itself to us as humans in order for us to participate. We are sort of the comic element, in that we don't see as well, hear as well, smell, strength, we don't have it. We don't have speed. We don't even have to bring our own clothes. We have to rely on the clothes that's given to us by other animals for us in order to simply survive. So we're the ones who are dependent, and therefore we should be the ones who are grateful. And you contrast that with this idea of discover and conquer and then dominate and turn everything into a commodity to produce wealth. And it's a powerful interaction. And in general, you get rolled under by it. If you're indigenous people, the history is that eventually tribes in the lower 48 are dominated and then sidelined and then pressed into ever smaller sections of their former homelands. And that's a sneak preview of coming attractions for Alaska Native peoples, unless history is turned, unless the tide of history is actually redirected into something new. And that's what Alaska Native peoples are doing. And it requires all of us to make that happen. Half of our population are women, of course. And if you're a fraction of the size, you got to take advantage of every strength you have. So why leave 50% of your strength off the table, right? It's simply suicidal. So we've had to learn how to work together more coherently than historically many of the Western nations have done. One of the things that I think is remarkable is I remember in a lot of meetings in Northwest Alaska and at statewide meetings of Alaska Natives when I was in my 20s, there would be women at the meetings. By the time I was in my 40s, it became notable when there were men at the meetings. And at a lot of them, there's a generational shift that's gone on. I remember getting teased towards, you know, just before I retired about, oh, you're the token Alaska Native guy in our meeting, because I would be the only one in the room, or there might be a couple of us. And that transformation has happened, and we have to pay attention to how that occurred and why. But what we are seeing is within, I think, the Alaska Native community, that we've had a much faster recognition of where strength comes from. And the part that we're trying to do now is, oddly enough, is trying to figure out, well, how did Alaska Native males start to lose our step in how to participate in so many of these organizations? It's an interesting set of dynamics to consider.
Well, I think women have been overlooked as a voting group. I mean, first of all, in the whole population, and sometimes even in the Native groups. But they have been the ones who have attended the meetings. They brought their kids to the meetings, so their kids grew up listening to this stuff. And they just gained knowledge, so we'll just have to see where it goes in the next 20 years with the things that are happening in our Congress and stuff over minorities voting, which is pretty scary. Not stepping back, but going forward, you know, being in a position of going forward.
So these interviews, Nellie, that you did were done on the 40th anniversary of ANCSA. And part of that conversation was about how the younger generation is not as interested in some of the early causes of ANCSA and more focused on the dividends that they get. And just kind of a concern that the young people are not going to carry on, or they need to be more interested in things.
You know, like I was just saying, we have to be focused on the future and making sure that our kids have those other rights as Alaska Natives than just getting a dividend, because some of the corporations, you know, they don't have minerals or they don't have gas line on their property, and it's hard for them to make a lot of money. You have to pay attention. And you have to know what's going on, and you have to know who's trying to do what to ANCSA. I mean, we're still, for how many years, faced a big fight over subsistence rights. My goodness, how much money was spent on that and trying to create subsistence in a different way. But the court said that subsistence was the number one priority on Native lands in Alaska. Thank God. There's going to be a lot going on over the next 20 years.
Well, one of the things that Brenda Itta talks about is the quality of the leadership back then. I want to play this excerpt from Brenda Itta's interview where she talks about the quality of the leadership that was around for the land claims fight.
We saw a lot of changes beginning to happen to our traditional subsistence way of life. But I really, really admire the intelligence of our leaders and our forefathers, who were so intelligent. They learned the English language. They learned how to read. Our leaders were very studious. They studied the law. They studied about what our rights were, civil rights, our divine rights, and how does it relate to all these new things that are coming into our country, because into our country, I guess that's the right term. Mm-hmm. It was our land. Where do we stand? Where do we take our position in the midst of all that?
So, Jacqueline, you know, what's your reaction to what Brenda said? Is that looking back at the past with rose-colored glasses, you think?
I think there was remarkable leadership in both the years leading up to the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act and the years following. They definitely had a hard row to hoe. Looking back now, it seems almost overwhelming and almost impossible. And it's amazing what they were able to accomplish. So when I listen to youth at Elders and Youth Conference that is put on by First Alaskans, I'm often impressed with the wisdom of the young people. And I'm just blown away at how smart and articulate they are and how knowledgeable. And I won't name names, but really there are some outstanding young women in different parts of the state who are involved either with their village corporation or their regional corporation, their tribe, or maybe at a borough or city council, and they're honing their leadership skills. And I think what fosters leadership is both necessity and opportunity. So there come times when people are just pushed to the wall and they have to act. And regardless of the support they see out there for themselves or the opposition that they have to overcome. And when I say the support that they see out there for themselves, I'm thinking mostly in terms of bureaucratic support. Do you have the Miners Association on your side? Do you have the Chamber of Commerce on your side? Do you have the state governor on your side? Do you have a majority of the legislators or people in Congress on your side? Sometimes you don't have that kind of support, but you do have the support of elders and people in your community. And with that, that's what gave the leaders of those early years the strength and the determination to carry on. If the time comes and the young people are the only ones who can do it, they will definitely rise to the occasion.
When you think about what was going on in the country at the time, and these women were in the White House office, these women were in senators' offices, congressmen's offices, helping to make the case. You just have to appreciate the tremendous amount of courage that it took, especially in the face of so much discrimination, which is some of what they talk about. Nellie, you want to share some thoughts on what women had to face? I mean, what everyone had to face going into these meetings.
Not only is it aimed at women, but, you know, back in the day, if you weren't rich or your family wasn't a longstanding wealthy family, you didn't get recognized. You were some poor little Native person. No way was anybody going to talk to you. But now we've grown in stature.
These negotiations were very much a roller coaster that Native people had to ride and hang on to for dear life. And I want to play this excerpt from Marlene Johnson, where she talks about at the very end of ANCSA, just before they're about to come to an agreement, the roller coaster takes another wild swing. So let's listen.
When we had the land claims almost settled and they knew the pipeline could get built, the state administration, the governor, etc., were all back in D.C. as we were, and Henry Scoop Jackson was our friend, and he had put this package together that we didn't like at all, but we could live with it. And Scoop was going to Chicago for a meeting, and the other group was met there in D.C. And that evening, Senator Gravel came and told us that we were being sold down the pipe. They'd cut a deal with the state of Alaska, and we were losing a lot of acreage.
And so our leadership, the Willie Hensleys, the Tim Wallace, John Borbidge, and all of them, they called Scoop's office, and they got a hold of Scoop Jackson, and he turned his plane around. He was in a military plane.
Wow.
He turned his plane around, came back to D.C., and put the package back together. And you know, I'll always be thankful to him for that.
What did it take to get that kind of a reaction from Senator Scoop Jackson to come back and rescue this?
Probably the Malamute Saloon, because that's where I saw him. I'm sorry.
It was those photos at the Malamute Saloon.
I feel like there's another story here we should hear about.
Right. Oh, boy.
That, to me, is a really amazing story that Scoop Jackson would drop everything to come to the rescue of the land claims. So it seems like there must have been a lot of relationship building on the part of the Native negotiators just to get that kind of commitment from a U.S. senator.
The thing about Scoop Jackson is that he's very aware of the need for a new chapter in tribal relations with the United States, because up until then, in many ways, it's just one travesty after another of injustice, one injustice after another. And trying to find a different approach and seeing the opportunity being offered by Alaska Native leadership to say, let's do something different and that's more equitable, that there's less injustice involved. We're never going to get what our lands are worth, because if we got paid what our lands and waters are worth by the federal government, Alaska Natives would make the Saudis look like punks. I mean, it's a vast amount of resources that the United States is going to extinguish Native claims to for a fraction of the market value. And everybody knows that. So the question is there a way in which this can at least allow a new chapter in self-determination? And Scoop Jackson learns to embrace this sense of purpose, of something new and better. And it's full of inconsistencies, and there are half-completed chapters and things that undermine the status of tribes within ANCSA. And yet, the other way to understand it is grading on the very low curve of how things had gone before, it's dramatically better than that.
So I want to play this clip from Women Behind the Act. This is from your interview with Brenda Itta. She is walking down a street in Washington, D.C. with Charlie Etook Edwardson, one of the more radical fighters for the Claims Act, and they go inside a building somewhere, and suddenly these words from the Declaration of Independence catch their eye. So let's listen.
We looked up the stairs, and up there was inscribed, I'll never forget this, I wrote it down so I won't forget that, where it says that we are one nation under God, endowed by our Creator with the unalienable rights, we as Americans, unalienable rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Mm-hmm. And because we were Americans, we had those same rights endowed to us by our Creator. So we looked at that. Etook and I meditated on that. And then the other thing that, you know, I recall is remembering what we all learned in school, and that is the Pledge of Allegiance to mm-hmm. the flag. I must have truly believed the words. It says, we are one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Mm-hmm. And I always thought that the justice for all applied to all of us. Mm-hmm. You know, at the time, that knowledge became very pronounced to me, very clear to me, that we had these divine rights. We had these basic rights. And during that moment of discouragement, where are we? It seemed like all of America were enjoying these certain Bill of Rights, but where are we as the Alaska Native people? Mm-hmm. So there were some moments of that, but it made us very determined, mm-hmm. I think, to push for the land claim settlement anyway, regardless of some opposition.
So, Paul, you want to tell us a little bit about Charlie Edwardson, who he was? And it's kind of interesting that he and Brenda were walking together because they seem very different, like night and day, in their personalities.
Charlie Edwardson was very important, I think, in the same way that Malcolm X is out in the wings so that Martin Luther King Jr. can look like the reasonable person to negotiate with. If you don't want to deal with him, then over here is Malcolm X. And the American politicians much preferred going with what they perceived to be a moderate position. And I think people underestimate that Charlie Edwardson was the frightening alternative. If ANCSA doesn't bring home some kind of reasonable settlement, if AFN does not bring home some degree of success, that it's a time in which there are people who are politically bombing campuses in the United States. There are armed insurrection groups, revolutionaries in the United States at the time, and they're active. And the thought that you could somehow protect or control Native peoples if they want to really stop a pipeline, it just seems almost impossible for that to occur. So the intensity is just not, I think, emphasized enough in the way we describe the history of ANCSA. Charlie Edwardson helps to provide that sense of intensity in what's at stake.
Those words were pretty powerful. I almost felt a little choked up when I heard them.
I did too. You know, when she was saying them, it's interesting because when we were kids in school, you know, I started out in the BIA school in Kotzebue. We had to say the Pledge of Allegiance before we started anything in school. And almost everything in town as a community group would start with that. And it sort of surprised me that she and Edok had that reaction to it. But at the same time, I felt good about it because, you know, I always thought, why do we have to have a card that says I'm Native? Why is it in the front of the room on both sides of the chalkboard? One side says white kids and the other says Native kids. You know, why is that? So when she started talking about justice for all, and I was kind of moved by it too.
So I think that it reminds us that politics is complicated. There are people who are motivated by trying to get as many goodies for their constituents as can be and haunted by the idea of failure, that they might fail to get reelected. And there are people who are trying to be very creative, as the saying goes. There are people who are trying to be governed by our better angels. They're trying to be governed by these kinds of ideals. And if you can bring those to the forefront at the right time with the right person, they can be very powerful.
All right, it's now time for the dessert that I've been promising you. And my very favorite part of Women Behind the Act is when Brenda Itta tells a story about a loan the Alaska Federation of Natives got from the Yakima tribe and what they had to put up as collateral. Well, Joe Upikson negotiated that loan, and the first Brenda learns about the collateral part of the deal is when Joe delivers a gift to her from the chief of the tribe.
He presented me with this beautiful Yakima Indian Nation made belt, beaded work, beautiful bead work and leather. I think it was elk. It was a belt, and he gave it to me. This is a gift from, I believe his name was...
Robert Jim.
This is a gift from Chief Robert Jim. We just got a loan from the Yakima Indian Nation, and his question to us was, What about a collateral? I need a collateral for this loan I'm giving to AFN. So Joe said, well, our response was that we didn't have any cash, we didn't have any title to the land, so we don't have anything to give you. And as far as cash is concerned and land, so apparently, I don't know who talked to the chief, but apparently everybody understood that the chief of the Yakima Indian Nation at the time could have more than one wife. He had many wives. And apparently the best that the men could do was come up with potentially 3 Alaska Native women to use as collateral to AFN. And I believe Frances Degnan was named, I was named, and I think it was either Mary Jane Fate or Laura Burke. Laura Burke.
Mary Jane came afterwards.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We were apparently used as a collateral. And I think that made us...
How did it
us,
feel? I mean, did
well,
it...
That made me very determined to see the land sure. claim settled.
Did you expect to hear that story, Nellie?
Not at all. They were all kind of giggling about it and telling the story. And I was just totally fascinated because it just sounded so typically Native. Well, what's our collateral going to be? You know, trying to give them a hard time and them saying that they would take 3 women as collateral for Pete's sake. So.
Yeah. Paul, I know that you're familiar with this story, that you heard it years ago on the North Slope. What was the setting for that?
We were in, then it was Barrow. We were doing a workshop for managers, for new employees for Arctic Slope Regional Corporation. And in those meetings, she would share her perspectives about how Arctic Slope Regional Corporation came about. And I'd heard the story about the Yakima Nation and the loan and the conditions of the loan. And yet I'd never actually heard her at that time directly address it. So we'd done these meetings, I don't know, 2 or 3 times by that point. And when she was going through her sense of how Arctic Slope Regional Corporation came about, and the origins of ANCSA, there was a pause, and I asked her about how it came about that the Yakima tribe of Washington would have provided a loan for AFN. And she just shot me a look when I brought it up, paused for a moment, and then related the story to the group. And it was stunning to everyone in the room, except for the people who actually also had heard this story. I can certainly tell you that for the new employees, that was this is not just another corporation. There's a remarkable history and a sense of commitment involved in the organization that we're becoming a part of.
This has been so much fun talking with the 3 of you. I wondered if you had any parting thoughts to share before we go. And I just want everyone to remember that Women Behind the Act was recorded 20 years ago. So it's been quite some time, but it seems like it stands the test of time.
I'm just really impressed by the person who did the interviews, because they're just done in a way that makes the people being interviewed comfortable, and there's a sense of relaxed, sort of enjoyable atmosphere. You just have to give credit, because the interviews just come to life, each one of them. They're just fun to listen to and watch.
Yes, good job, Nellie.
Good Thanks, job.
I had so much fun.
Well, it's interesting because Irene Rowan, who has organized a lot of these panels over the years, this is a cause that's near and dear to her heart, to talk about the women behind the act.
Yeah, and there's much more awareness now. She has a group of women she hangs with, and they're pretty vocal, strong women. So, and plus she's cranked, so, right, Jacqueline?
What do you mean by that?
I mean that when you'd have Tlingit women walk into a room, you just better stay sharp.
Yeah. Do your duty.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, we got to give Irene Rowan and her Tlingit tenacity kudos for realizing how important it was to get everyone together for that conversation with you, Nellie, 10 years ago. And I want to thank the three of you for being here to give us an appreciation of this gem. Nellie Moore, Jacqueline Estes, two longtime Alaska Native journalists and among some of the best in the business. Also, thanks to Paul Onktagook for sharing his expertise. Although he recently retired from the University of Alaska Anchorage, he is still teaching us. Thank goodness for that. I'm Rhonda McBride. Thank you for joining us for this companion podcast for the series ANCSA at 50, The Journey Continues. Hope you enjoyed hearing about the women behind the act.